Welcome to the SearchHealthIT.com podcast, where SearchHealthIT.com editors interview leading experts on IT strategies for healthcare leaders.
Hi, this is Brian Eastwood, site editor for SearchHealthIT.com. I'm joined today by Lisa Pfeiffer, the president of Core Competence, who is going to be addressing some conceptions and misconceptions folks might have about mobile device security in a healthcare setting. Thanks for joining us today, Lisa.
Well, thank you, Brian.
Okay, so basically the way we're going to present this is I'm going to be making kind of a few statements, and Lisa will say true or false or yes or no. Our first statement: any sort of risk analysis should precede a mobile device deployment.
Well, this one I think is pretty obviously true. Mobile devices can help improve the quality and cost of healthcare, but of course regulations do require providers to secure personal health information. What we've seen in the past, for example, in 2010 high-tech data breaches, most of them were attributed to laptops as opposed to paper records and server and desktop hacks. And as we start using mobile devices more and more, those risks are going to be shifting onto tablets and smartphones. Of course, you know, mobile devices really are already widely used in healthcare. It's hard to find a physician that's not carrying a smartphone. Studies show about 30% already access electronic health records or radiology results on their iPads. So we really can't hit the rewind button and somehow pause on these mobile deployments, but what we can do is immediately conduct a risk assessment. What I mean by that is you start by identifying what the sensitive assets are, in this case, PHI, electronic health records, and medical images, as well as the systems and the networks that store them. You want to identify all the individual users and mobile devices that actually touch those assets and look for vulnerabilities in access control, confidentiality, and integrity. I tell people to use a what-if scenario to identify not just potential breaches, but actually the likelihood and impact of each, because together those factors determine your risk and they help you prioritize whatever mobile security policies and practices you're going to put into place. For example, many providers do start by remotely wiping smartphones and tablets. They do that because the frequency of mobile device loss and theft is really quite high. Now, you might not lock down every mobile device. What you can do is try to narrow those big gaps before they're exploited.
Okay. Like you said, that was a fairly easy one. Next thought that a lot of people have about this is that no mobile operating system is more or less secure than the other.
Well, this one I'll take issue with. You know, every mobile operating system has its own security model, its own ecosystem. And I think to lump iOS and Android and Windows Phone and BlackBerry all together is really to ignore some really key differences in their native capabilities, in the applications they run, and in the policies and usage that they experience. Of course, you know, we talk about best practices, and the same best practices do apply to devices that are powered by all of those operating systems. They all support device-level access controls like PINs and passwords. They all can run on phones and tablets that support hardware data encryption and remote data wipe. But I think that when we focus on those superficial similarities, we ignore some important details, both in implementation and in vulnerabilities. And I'll give you one example of that. It's often said that Androids are more vulnerable to malware than iPhones. Underneath the covers, both operating systems do sandbox applications and data. They both use permissions to limit the access that any applications have to data and features. But a really critical difference for Android is the ecosystem that surrounds the mobile operating system. Apple approves all applications that can be installed on iPhones and iPads, and they do that prior to distribution based on code review and verified signatures. By comparison, Google relies on marketplace feedback to spot and pull malicious Android applications. Any developer can publish them without review. So in short, malware exploits are actually happening more often on Android, but it's the ecosystem, not the operating system. Another example is that Android 3 and 4, they can both encrypt stored data. The operating system is capable of doing it, but not every phone and tablet actually has the ability to support hardware encryption. The vast majority of phones that will ship this year actually can't. And so my advice is to assess specific devices, make and model, and their ability to support your security policies. Don't get stuck on what operating system they run as your only criteria.
Okay, that's definitely some good advice. And sort of building on that is the third point, is whether native device security capabilities will be sufficient for a healthcare organization's mobile security best practices.
Well, native device capabilities are, of course, an excellent foundation, but I would say this one is false, because most healthcare organizations actually need to do more than what's natively offered in order to really fully address their risk, as well as reliably enforce whatever policies they may put into place and then report on usage. And I'll give you an example of that. Contemporary smartphones, they all include access controls. Tablets used for patient education, and simple password might be sufficient. But if you have a tablet that's used by several workers to access electronic healthcare records, you probably have to require two-factor authentication to control and audit individual use by that same device. Another example, most mobile devices accept remote lock and wipe, but what those commands actually do, how effective they are, that varies. So I think healthcare providers have to actually be able to prove that a device carrying regulated data was in fact wiped. Confirmed partial and full wipe, along with centralized reporting, is going to require you to outfit devices with third-party agents. Another example here is mobile operating system security. Depending on the operating system, it can actually be hard for third parties to provide effective onboard malware scanners. The great example of that is Apple devices. And that's, again, because of the code review that we talked about and limited access to operating system features. And for this reason, I think that healthcare providers have to consider applying anti-malware at the network edge, or in the cloud, so to speak, scanning email messages and web responses before they actually hit those mobile devices. So, again, bottom line is, do start with those native capabilities and make the most of them. Just don't let your policy actually be limited to whatever a mobile operating system can do on a device.
Okay. Sort of building a little bit on that answer, you know, native mobile device managers, as well as third-party mobile device managers, can enhance mobile device security policies. Is that a good thing, or do you think there's a little more that needs to be done there?
I definitely think that mobile device managers can play an important role in enhancing mobile device security policies. If you think about it, configuring mobile device security settings by hand is not really tenable for a healthcare provider, and it's not just a matter of numbers. It's actually a matter of being able to, you know, rigorously enforce and track your policies. With a mobile device manager, providers can actually control enrollment, provisioning, real-time monitoring, reporting, you know, application installation, as well as perform some centrally initiated commands. For example, let's think about if you use a mobile device manager to put up a self-help enrollment portal, that will actually deter inappropriate use of manually configured personal devices that you don't want to actually authorize for use in your environment. Instead, what an enrollment portal can do is actually authenticate each user, assess each device, and then automatically provision whatever the appropriate security settings are for that user and that device. And with this approach, you can easily generate reports later on that list all the devices that you've enrolled, who owns them, when they were provisioned, and even the last time that they were contacted. All this can be very important in demonstrating your compliance. Similarly, if a caregiver actually misplaces their iPad, a mobile device manager gives you the capability to immediately disable any regulated network or email access by that device just by removing some of the configuration profiles that were put there in the first place. And if that iPad's never recovered, you can remotely wipe it or you can de-enroll it, which removes its access to your network and your systems. Either way, you'll have reports that tell you when the lock or wipe occurred, and that avoids both risk to healthcare information as well as the need to report that as a potential data breach. The other thing I like to caution people, though, when thinking about mobile device management and security, is that managers themselves, they don't really secure mobile devices. Security controls have to be implemented by those native capabilities we talked about or third-party add-ons. Now, some mobile device management products do include some security features. A great example of that would be an encrypted data container. But if you're just looking at mobile device management to that device manager, security policies are just one of many things that can be configured on that device.
Okay. I know you mentioned a little bit about, you know, mobile end users and who they are and what they're doing. Is it a good idea to have all mobile device users given the same permissions? Is that more of a true or is that false?
Oh, that's definitely false. It would be great if the world worked that way, but patient privacy really starts with defining who should have access to specific kinds of information. And whatever your privacy policies are, actually dictate which caregivers and which roles should actually have permission to read and write data reached through specific networks and systems and applications. And that's going to filter down into different permissions. This is one reason why mobile enrollment actually has to be based not just on your user login, but actually on things like group membership, job description, device capabilities. And it's a combination of those criteria that determine how the device should be provisioned, you know, which subnets and applications it has access to, as well as things like whether two-factor authentication is going to be required in certain usage scenarios. An example is, you know, an iPad used for patient education. You might give it access to your entire wireless network, to the wireless network that provides encrypted Internet access, and you might prompt for a simple password when that's the purpose of setting up that iPad. But if you were setting up a different iPad to actually be used to review, say, radiology images, it'd probably be configured to connect to a different network that requires something stronger like device certificate authentication. And permission might even vary depending on the caregiver that's using the iPad at any point throughout the day. So I think in summary, you know, device capability and ownership, but also location can play a role in those permission policies.
All right. The next point is one that I think you've touched upon a little bit in some of your previous answers. You know, the use of remote controls such as auto wiping capabilities tend to be a good way to secure devices as they are moving around a facility and also off the facility to the, you know, proverbial doctor at the soccer game. Is that true or false?
I think that's definitely true. Remote commands, centrally initiated remote commands are very, very helpful for these on-the-go devices. Remotely initiated commands in combination, though, with automated policy-based actions, they can add an important layer of security. If you think about it, you know, unlike laptops that occasionally connect directly to our networks, many mobile devices actually never do. They may only connect to us over 3G and 4G networks, and they're almost always moving, so that over-the-air management is really essential to control and monitor those devices. Things like remote find can help you find a lost device or confirm that lost device has probably really been stolen, not just stuffed down a couch cushion. If a stolen tablet could still be reached, the ability to send it a remote wipe command can help you, you know, not just remotely eradicate the PHI on that device, but actually to wipe off those risky email settings and credentials that would let that device back in your network. Why I say that you really need to complement remote commands with automated actions, though, is that sometimes those stolen tablets are never going to be reachable again. That's why I think you should complement remote wipe with, say, an automated policy that locks an inactive tablet or wipes it after so many failed logins or upon SIM card removal. The techniques that thieves use to actually make use of a tablet and turn it over to someone else. And this comes back to your first question about risk assessment. I think you have to work through these scenarios to identify what these residual vulnerabilities are, and then just address the ones that are the most impactful to your workforce.
Okay. The final point is one that has also been brought up a little bit in some of your previous answers, and that regards encryption. You know, a lot of organizations encrypt data just at rest, and they think as long as data is encrypted at rest, they are fine. Is this true or false?
Well, no, false. Encrypting data at rest is a, you know, an absolute necessity. But you have to protect healthcare information end-to-end, from source to destination and every point along the way. If you store data on mobile devices, absolutely you have to protect it at rest. But if you avoid on-device storage, you still have to protect data in transit. For example, you can protect email messages and attachments in transit using TLS. If you need proof of message sender, you'll have to add something like a digital signing technology like SMIME. We also use TLS to secure web-based transactions, but when you do that, you still have to make sure that clients actually check that server certificate. And when we send data over wireless, we have to think about accidental exposures. For example, an iPad that normally syncs to a server over an encrypted wireless LAN at the office, it might also try to synchronize when it's connected to an open home or hotspot network. So this is why often healthcare providers add full-time VPN security to stop those data links by mobile devices in a network-independent way. And again, the key here is to seek and then remedy those gaps that could make the difference between reliable compliance and those really costly fines.
All right. That sort of finishes up the points I was looking to make. Lisa, are there any sort of additional comments about general mobile device security that you wanted to make in conclusion?
I guess the comment that I would make is that security often comes after the fact. And going back to your first question about assessing risk before deployment, I think we're all in the throes of mobility now and playing catch-up with mobile device security, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't pay attention to it. The risk is growing as we become more and more dependent on these devices and they become more powerful. So, there's no time like the present to take this a bit more seriously than we have in the past.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Lisa, for providing some really good input on mobile device security for healthcare providers. I think this will be quite helpful, as you said, as organizations continue to see mobile devices used and deployed in a fairly effective manner.
Thank you for listening to the SearchHealthIT.com podcast. For more information and resources about healthcare technology and electronic health records, please visit searchhealthit.com. Thank you.